Hello and welcome in.
First Science.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. Good morning. You are listening to Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. And what a show we've got coming up for you. Yeah, it's all about the brain, but not as you know it. What if I were to tell you that the most numerous cells in our brain are not neurons, the nerve cells that we hear so much about, but astrocytes, a name which literally means star-like cells. And we're still not sure exactly what they do. What we do know is they outnumber our brain cells 50 to 1, and some people believe they might hold the key to our intelligence. Joining me this morning is the fantastic Ali Jennings, a neuroscientist from UCL, who's been studying these most mysterious of brain cells. Good morning, Ali. How are you?
Morning. I'm very well.
Your brain awake today?
Sort of turning on, I think. There's a sputter.
It is pretty early. Now, as well as Ali's fantastic research, we have got not one, but two experiments for you this morning. Both looking at sensory perception. Kind of got one each. We just kid and choose.
Yeah, they're kind of like a parallel sort of set. Like one's a sort of ramped up version of the other one, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really sure I'd recommend you all try the second one, but...
The second one's real science. Like, we have no idea really whether that one's going to work.
Yeah, and I'm the guinea pig. Anyway, so what you're going to need for my experiment, which is to do with temperature perception, is three containers large enough to put your hands in, ice cream cartons, jugs, that sort of thing, and some hot and cold water. Ali, would you like to tell the others what they need?
Yeah, for mine, you're going to need as much mint, as in the mint plant, that you can get your hands on, and a chili.
A chili. I'm already nervous. We've also got our weekly brain teaser for you. And this week we're asking, how many brain cells does the average human brain have? If you think you know, you can tweet us at Soho Radio with the hashtag Science Mixtape. Ali, if you know, don't say. But on with the music. It's your mixtape. What have you chosen as song number one?
So my first one is Oscar Peterson, great jazz pianist. And it's the Astaire Blues, which actually... I mean, you'll hear it starts off pretty fast, but gets faster and faster and faster and faster and faster, and you won't actually hear the end, but he's basically going about the speed of a space rocket.
Wow.
The typical brain is about 2% of your body's weight, but uses 20% of its total energy.
That's insane. That's like a fifth.
Yeah.
So greedy of the brain.
Oh, yeah, but you've got to think about it. Like, if you think about what it's doing compared to everything else, I mean, it's good for it. It's good value for that energy.
That's true. Hey, I really liked that song. I didn't know, in my head, I was like, ooh, it's almost like all the different synaptic nerve communications sparkling around.
I like that.
That's exactly what you're going for, isn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly why I chose that song. I actually chose that song because it makes me feel insanely happy every time I hear it.
Aww.
Like, and because it gets fast at the end, you kind of feel like, oh my God, I'm so happy, I don't know if I could take it.
Right, so turning back to astrocytes, could you just start briefly by kind of explaining what they are and how they're different to a nerve cell?
Yes, obviously. So the astrocyte star cell, it's called that because it looks a bit like a star when you look at it down the microscope, down a fluorescent microscope. Not the microscope fluorescent, the star, the cell is fluorescent.
Yeah, they put like a fluorescent dye and it's all lit up and glowing.
Yeah, exactly. So when you see it, it looks like this sort of, yeah, it's sort of kind of got these kind of crazy sort of star-like tendrils and fronds and everything. But actually also, it's because they're so, they're kind of everywhere in the brain. They're absolutely everywhere. And they're really small. So when you look at them sort of from quite a low magnification, so you're looking at a big piece of brain and all these little cells, they kind of pop out. They're like stars in the night sky.
Oh.
Yeah, they're so beautiful, these little things.
Wow.
But anyway, so a neuron is basically, it's just a massive purpose-built machine, right? It's very well evolved to transfer messages over long distances, right? And also to collate information. Like, it can receive trillions of inputs. No, not trillions, incorrect. It can receive, like, thousands and thousands.
Yeah.
Trillions over the whole brain. And it receives all these inputs, and it can summate the information, it can compute what's going on, and then it can send information somewhere else in the
brain.
As
an electrical impulse.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and those distances can be absolutely massive, if you're thinking in cellular terms. So the longest one you have, this is a good fact, actually. Longest cell in your body?
Longest cell, I'm going to think of a nerve that runs through your leg.
Yes, boom. No,
is it actually?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Yeah, you're so on it. So it's the one that goes from the base of your spine, uh-huh. So just above your bum, to your big toe.
Right.
That is all one cell. And that's
that is huge.
And those are neurons, so they're really, really good at transmitting information very fast. Astrocytes, they can't do that. They don't have that electrical capacity. But there are so many, and they have this incredibly complicated shape. They're like bushes. And like, if you imagine a privet hedge, each with those tiny, tiny leaves and that sort of like a kind of round shape and very, very complicated branches.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're like. And they enwrap every single synapse.
And the synapse is a little gap between two neurons.
Exactly right. So where neurons meet and communicate, there's always an astrocyte, a little leaf which enwraps the synapse.
Mm.
And so you can imagine how many there are in the brain. There's so many of these things. And they're ubiquitous, and we just don't know what they're doing.
Yeah. So, because I was doing some reading, and it said that we used to think they just sort of did metabolic things. So someone referred to them as a neurovascular bridge, because, like, one of their tendrils...
Drop that.
I did really enjoy that. One of their tendrils will kind of link to a blood... be very near a blood capillary, and then the other part will be near the neuron, and it will, like... transport the sugar from the blood to the neuron.
Yeah. So whereas neurons have one job, right? Yeah. And they're really good at that job, and you just don't mess with me when I'm doing my job. Astrocytes, they have kind of a variety of things that they can do. Like, it's like you see someone, you're like, I've seen you doing this and I saw you doing that, but I don't know which one is like the main thing that you do. You're like a multi, they're like the prince of the brain, except they're like multi-instrumentalists. That's where I was going with that. And so part of what they do is they change the amount of oxygen they can get to the neurons. They also support neurons. Neurons are so busy basically sending information, they have no time to look after themselves, so they would just die without astrocytes. And the real question is, so yeah, it's fine supporting the energy needs of neurons and all that kind of stuff. Are they involved with thinking? Because if they were, if in some way they were changing the way that neurons were sending information, processing information, then we would have a whole other
structure that to sort of investigate.
Exactly. It's a whole like shadow brain that just layered behind all the neurons that we've been studying for so long. And we've only even really realized astrocytes might be doing this for the last 20 or so years.
Wow.
So it
to
is.
To me, it's sounding like, you know, how in space we have matter we can see, and then we have dark matter, which we think does so much more, and which is so much more. Is it like that, but
you
for the brain?
You are absolutely nailing this. Yeah, that's a great analogy. It is a lot like dark matter.
Wow.
And you can think of it like. And that's a really good analogy, because in space, obviously, the stars, they're kind of like massive burning balls of energy. They're quite visible, actually quite sparsely kind of populated, like scattered like sand through the cosmos, right? And then there's loads and loads of dark matter everywhere else where we just can't see it. And, you know, I don't know what the percentage is. But astrocytes are, like, by volume, they occupy so much volume of the brain. They're like a huge sponge, which sort of, and the neurons sort of thread their way through it. So, yeah, it's a lot like dark matter.
And in terms of, like, why we think they might be linked to the way that we think and our intelligence, I mean, so one thing that I read, which I found quite convincing, was that when they looked into Einstein's brain, so he died and they were like, right, let's see what made him so clever, and they took it apart. His brain was actually smaller than average.
Was
and,
it?
Yeah, didn't necessarily have more neurons, but what it did have was loads more astrocytes than normal.
Yes, good. That supports my like understanding of it. No, I don't know whether actually thinking about it. That's the first time I've heard that, which is quite exciting. it could be, but the thing is, it's like, yes, yes, there's all these sort of clues as to why they might be really important, but we still just have no idea what all those clues add up to. Like, so the Einstein's brain thing is part of a larger phenomenon that we've noticed as astrocyte scientists.
Yeah.
That,
Karen.
that as you go up through the ladders of intelligence, of animal intelligence, you get more and more astrocytes compared to neurons in your brain. So the proportion of astrocytes increases. So rats might have like a 1-to-1, like a mammal. Yeah, they're pretty smart. Humans, we have more. I can't remember the exact ratio. And they are far more complicated. And they're just huge, these astrocytes and neurons. They do so much, but we don't know what they're actually doing. We just know they do something.
That's crazy. And so what part were you looking at?
So my research was on, basically, when I turned out, you know, I was a fool. I was young and foolish. And I was so idealistic. And I was like, right, what's the sexiest thing I can think of studying, right? And strangely enough, I chose astrocytes. But they are kind of like a really sexy idea because they could hold the key to a whole new understanding of the brain. The other thing was, what's the second sexiest thing I can think of studying? Well, clearly that's going to be dopamine, because that's like the drug that's involved with addiction and desire and reward and all these kind of crazy things. And I was like, well, you know, what's the relationship between astrocytes and dopamine? And that is surprisingly not something that's really ever been done, at least not kind of seriously. Well, I say not seriously, but not in the way that I was doing it. So I did that. That's my research.
And what did you find?
Well, the answer that I came up with is that I don't know what they're doing. I know they're doing something, like that is clear. So when you add dopamine to astrocytes, you take the chemical and you kind of put it on some of these cells, the astrocytes, they have the most beautiful response. It's like watching a firework display. They just start pinging off these, they start flashing. So you're looking at them in a dish, say, right? And they start to sort of they're burning, like, and they suddenly flare up, and then they're kind of crackling away, like in the background, with these little bursts of activity. And then suddenly they'll kind of like roar up, and then they'll drop back down again. And that's something that they do when you put the dopamine on, you take it off, they stop.
Oh, and so they're definitely interacting with it.
They definitely, but I then spent like years trying to find out whether that interaction was having an effect on the brain proper, and I just could not see it. I didn't know where to look or what they could be doing. I tried lots of different ways and I never saw anything. But I think that's not because they're not having an effect, but rather because I didn't know where to look.
Yeah. And also I think the process of studying brain cells can change how they react, but we're going to come on to that later in another section.
I
could talk about this all day. But time for song two, or we will not get all the songs in. So what's your song two?
I think it's, is it Kenny Rogers?
It is Kenny Rogers, just dropped in.
Yeah. So this is the kind of feeling I had when I first came into the lab, like my PhD lab. I had this, like, it's like this was the feeling in my brain.
Yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in. I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky. I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Although pain is processed in your brain has no pain receptors and feels no pain.
And that explains how brain surgery can be performed while the patient is awake.
Great facts.
So, speaking of pain receptors, it is time for our weekly experiment. We're not trying to induce pain reception. We may accidentally. We're more looking at temperature reception and the phenomenon of neural adaptation, which is where your nerves get desensitized by what they are responding to.
I just jump at it. If you think about wearing clothes, when you put clothes on, you definitely feel like you're putting them on. Halfway through the day, you don't feel like you're wearing clothes.
Yeah.
So that's because your neurons have adapted to the fact that you're wearing clothes. They're like, they're not sending information about that anymore.
Yeah,
it's not useful.
They've got used to the touch sensation of those clothes. That is a really good example. Okay, so we're going to start with temperature perception and how we perceive temperature. So what we have is one jar of cold water. And if you don't believe me, we've actually got some ice. Ali, would you just mind?
Shall I scrunch the ice into the mic?
Putting the last few bits of ice in.
Okay, here's the sound of ice. Is that audible?
Beautiful. And we also have some water from a kettle, so we've sort of boiled it and let it sit, and we're going to pour that into our warm jug.
I'm pretty scared about the temperature of this water.
It's fine, yeah. I did put my hand in the kettle earlier. Is that feeling all right?
It feels good. Yeah, it's been
cool,
like a bath.
Cool. Exactly, that's what it should be. It should be hot, not to burn you, hot like a bath. And then you need a third container of just room temperature water. So from the tap, let it sit. Now, Ali, I'm going to ask you to put one hand in the hot, one hand in the ice. I mean, it's ice and water, not completely icy. You don't want to like, get an ice burn. And you've got to hold it in there for 60 seconds. And while you're doing that, you can explain what I'm going to be doing.
Oh, that is cold. Oh, and delightfully warm.
Is it quite weird?
It is really weird. So... building on that, my hands. Building on that idea of adaptation. So, another kind of set of receptors. Well, they're the same temperature receptors. So, there's cool and hot. So, chili has a chemical in it which artificially activates those hot receptors. That's why they taste hot, even though they're not actually physically hot. And mint, menthol, has one which artificially activates cold receptors, which is why chewing gum makes your mouth feel cold.
Mm-hmm.
So my thinking is that if you eat both of those at the same time, you should feel nothing.
And that,
yeah, exactly. And it should be like you've eaten neither mint nor chili.
So do I eat them both at the same time?
To be honest, yeah, why not?
And how much should I be eating?
I think you should eat as much mint as possible and a small amount of chili.
Okay, so I've got like a good handful of leaves right here.
It's a sprig, a large sprig.
Now, I'm skeptical because in our skin, we have different receptors for hot and cold, as we will see with Ali. So in
my
mouth,
feeling that right now.
If I have different receptors for hot and cold, I'm not sure they'll cancel each other out. But anyway.
Well, I mean, because they should reach the brain and they'll say, right, well, there's two different things they should maybe.
Well, I've put you through some discomfort, so here goes. Sorry, listeners. Okay, that's a mint. Twilight mint. Not really.
Wow, that is brave. A proper bite of the chili there. Really just took the edge off it. How's that? I mean, you can't describe what's happening, but I can describe to you what I've... She's looking confused. Not actually in pain, though. Or hot or cold. Take another bite of the chili. Incredible scenes.
You know what? I think it might have worked because I just mashed up the chili into the like ball of leaves. And I'm not feeling the chili yet.
I just cannot believe that's actually... I tried this twice at home, and both times I ran around my flat going, ha, 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 why?
Oh, no, wait, yeah. They're starting to burn. oh, dear. Okay, has that been 60 seconds? Oh, God.
That was more my reaction as well. So my feeling as to why that might... Like, it might work at the start and not at the end. Could be...
I think the after effects are... Ow.
Yeah, I think it's an after effect thing because chili, the capsaicin, the chemical in it which makes you feel hot, is also activates the pain receptors, which I don't think are either hot or cold, they're just pain. So that's probably what's happened there. I did not tell you that was going to happen.
No!
But, you know, I mean,
oh, my tongue is on fire.
That's a good result. Can I take my hands out of this water now? Because I can't feel them.
Producer Yaz, I think you should take over for a little bit. I'm going to drink some water.
Okay, great. No problem. So, Ali, you've had your hands in both the hot and the cold water for a little while now. I think it's probably about time that you took both of those out, isn't it?
I'd like that.
Okay, so in one of your hands, you've had the thermoreceptors reacting to the very hot water, and the other hand, the very cold water, and now you've put both of your hands into... neutral room temperature water, and can you describe what's going on now?
It's delightful. My cold hand is now warm and fuzzy, and my hot hand is pleasantly cool.
Okay.
Does it feel like the same?
The burning sensation that you're feeling.
Oh God, no! But for each hand, does it feel the same temperature?
No, God, no. My hand, which was very cold, now feels really warm, and my hand, which was very warm, now feels delightfully cool. Although I'm clearly in the same thing of water, that's definitely worked.
Yeah.
So, but the chili and menthol, like, I'm excited that worked at the start. Like, that's proper good science where you're like, yes, it seems to be working, and then it suddenly takes like a tangent. You're like, oh my god.
Oh yeah. It can be very unexpected.
Yeah, I did not. It's an unexpected result. That's the best kind of result.
So, when you've got your two hands in the water. And they're feeling. Are they uncomfortable when you put them in the room temperature water?
They were uncomfortable when I was freezing and burning
hot.
But no, when they go into the water, it's just like it's just a really nice sort of contrast. Like, oh, God.
Okay. How is Matilda doing?
I think I'm okay. I just want to add that. So this hot cold thing, that is this neural adaptation thing. It's evolutionary advantageous. I think the air makes my tongue hurt even more.
You've taken one for the team science there. That's.
Because if you're in a surrounding and you're feeling comfortable, that's fine. But any change, you should be alerted to straight away because change could be danger. That is why if you go into a new room, you will really notice its smell, especially if it smells bad. But after 5 minutes, you won't notice the smell anymore. And so with the hot and the cold, how it's actually working is your hot receptors are becoming desensitized in the hot water. So when you then put it in the neutral, your cold receptors are activated more than the hot ones because they're still a bit desensitized. So it seems colder than it is, and vice versa with the hand that was in the cold. It's just a really cool little thing that you can try at home and trick people into thinking that the same water is two different temperatures.
We are change sensing machines, that all living things, like if you're a living thing, it doesn't really matter if you're just in the same environment all the time, you don't really care. But as soon as your environment starts changing, that's when you have to be on it and ready
and
to sense it.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to let you do a bit more talking so my tongue can have a fiery break. Song three, you've picked Rachmaninoff, Symphony number 2, the Adagio Movement 3.
it's pretty full on this one. Yeah, I mean, it sounds a bit left field, but I mean, there is a reason for it. So, I've kind of like a lot. So these kind of music choices sort of mirror a bit my journey through my PhD, and this is when I was farmed out. I've been at the lab for like a few months, and they farmed me out to another lab. I basically in my old lab I'd just been breaking stuff, and I was just awful. And they were like, "Right, listen, go work in another lab, experience some other things, learn a new technique. It'll be great, you know, go science." So I turned up to this lab alone, right? And I got there and I got in and it was empty. And so there's no one there, all this kind of like really old school physiology equipment knocking about. I was like, oh my God, where is everyone? I'm supposed to meet someone here. So I just looked around, there's no one there. And then I found this door, which closed. And behind it, I could hear this sort of noise. I didn't really know what it was. I was like, oh, okay. So I pushed open this door and half the room, this really big old sort of physiology lab room, half it is curtained off with these black curtains. And I realised this music is coming from behind those curtains and it's massively loud, right? So it's clearly like big speakers turned up full, really, really loud. And I just stick my head through the curtains and in the darkness is this silhouette of this enormous man crouched over an ice tray surrounded by tools, like metal tools, you know. And the ice tray is illuminated in fluorescent green light. I was looking at this and this music was blaring in my ears from these speakers all over the room. And he was hunched over this thing and inside it was a cadaver because he'd been doing a dissection.
Cadaver is a dead body.
Yeah, and not a human one. And this music was swelling and kind of like roaring around me. And he just turns around and looks over his shoulder at me. And then in complete silence just goes back to what he's doing. And that was the first time I ever met this guy. And in this lab that I had to work in for 4 months. And this was the music that was playing.
A piece of brain tissue the size of a grain of sand contains 100,000 neurons and 1 billion synapses, all communicating with each other. A single neuron connects with, on average, 40,000 synapses.
So, coming back to the challenges of studying the brain and brain cells, I mean, I know that we can study the brain by imaging, but you were actually looking at real brains, weren't you?
Yeah. So, you have to make a choice, really, when you study any kind of brain tissue. So if you're a human, obviously no one is going into you and being like, right, I'll just have a little nosy around, we'll try some experiments, la la la. So so if you really want to try and understand the micro world of the brain, which is totally different from like how you imagine it, it's like a forest in there of all different kind of things going on. And if you want to understand that, you have to look at real brain tissue. Mm. And so I used to work on animals, and I used to dissect brain tissue out.
In like really thin slices, right?
Yeah, exactly. So you'd have to dissect out their brain and then slice their brain tissue up into very thin slices, which gives you this kind of cross-section of whatever piece of the brain that you're looking at. And then... you can put that under a very high-powered microscope, and then you start to really be able to see what is going on at the cellular level, which is really where, to use a cliche, where the magic happens.
What was that like? Because I guess it's so easy to see headlines in the newspaper and read about people's research, and I think sometimes you think about the fact that it may have been done on rats and mice, but often you don't even think about it at all. You just think about the results they got. But day in and day out, you were sort of working with that reality. And what was that like? Was that a challenge?
It's really interesting. It's never easy. It never got easier. Your job is to try and like see into a part of the brain that no one else has seen before. And the best way of doing that is to take tissue from something that was just alive. And you can do it on things which aren't very clever, right? So I don't think anybody would have a problem here killing a fly. Well, most people probably wouldn't, right?
God, their brains must be tiny. How would you even see anything?
Okay. I mean, they're surprisingly sophisticated, he said. But if you really want to start getting close to understanding what the cellular world is like in our brains, you really have to do it on a mammal. And all mammals are intelligent. And rats and mice... So mice, I don't have a huge amount of, like, affection for. They're really aggressive, and they're kind of dumb. And they just sort of, like... They look cute, but it's a facade. Like, they just want to bite you and have sex. That's all they're into. And smell. Whereas rats, they get really bad press. Rats are much cleverer than mice. Their brains are about, I don't know, two or three times a bit the size. Maybe even four times, depending on how big the rat is. And they have a much more interesting social life. They're much better at problem solving. Mm. And they're very soulful.
I once looked after a pet rat for a weekend, like back when I was 8, but it was also called Matilda. And yeah, it was so great. I just remember thinking it was such an like awesome little animal.
They are, and the thing is, when you have, so they're bred, so they'd be bred to undergo, to be killed, to for science, right? And that's something that everybody, if you don't think about, you should think about at least once, just because, you know, it's done to make our lives better, and this happens all the time.
And it's not just for science. We breed cows and sheep to eat them. So, I mean, it is a reality of the world we live in.
Exactly. But when you have to kill this thing... So, you know, I remember the first time I did it. And it's such a shock because you know it's going to happen, but then you have to do it. And I'm holding this little thing. And rats, they're not like mice, which just kind of like, scritter around, and then you have to kind of grab them and kill them. But... rats are intelligent enough to know something, that something's about to happen, and they're intelligent enough to feel fear. So when you hold it, they look at you and you look at it, and you know that it knows something bad's about to go down, and it's impossible not to feel awful, really. Like, you just feel really sorry for this, and you feel sorry that you have to do it. And I've seen, like, hardened scientists, people who've been doing it for years, and it never gets any easier for them. And they always have this moment is where everything kind of cuts out, and they have this sort of moment with the animal that they're going to do it with. Yeah, it's just... It kind of makes you appreciate them way more as well, because... Yeah, they're really, really soulful things.
Mm. And I guess not an animal that most people have day-to-day contact with.
Well, probably more so than we would imagine. But yeah, so it's really like... And the other thing is that makes you really appreciate what you then go on do. So when you kill it, you try and kill it in the most humane way possible, which takes practice, ironically. So once you've killed it, you see people... You know, the kind of flow state, or it's when someone just completely...
They're really focused. Yeah,
exactly. Everything goes. And the moment that animal dies, they are gone. Like, and they... Until the point where, you know, they have to leave the tissue for a while just to rest, you can't come near them. And I've seen people be like, hey, can you come and help me with my solutions, please? And, like, you just... They'll never talk to that person again. Like, it's just so... You're so... in it for that moment, that time when you had to do that horrible thing, that you just, yeah.
And then, so if once you've sort of killed your rat, how long would you be able to look at that particular animal's brain for?
Depends on what you're doing. So if you're looking at, yeah, so if you maybe have, oh, it depends how well you did it, right? So you maybe have between 2 and 4 hours. And then you have to get whatever experiment you're doing set up in that time and then run it before everything dies.
Yeah.
And then try and do as many of those as possible before the tissue is gone. And that's a skill thing, and that's, you know, that's why you have to spend so long, like, just doing it and doing it and doing it and doing it. But yeah, the thing about, like, one of the, like, unspoken sort of things that bugbears in the world of science is, like, or, like, the world of science I was in, is that tissue, when you cut it, brain tissue especially, if you cut it and you excise it and you knock it around, you, like, move it all around and all this kind of stuff, you hit it. So you're constantly bashing it, right, regardless of how careful you are. And that's not really a model of how your brain works. Your brain's very carefully cocooned and it's all quite stable. So as you're bashing this thing, even though you're trying to be really careful, you are changing the brain structure and the chemistry and what the cells
are doing.
The
environment that it's in.
Exactly right. And you try and keep the environment as close as possible, but you always change a little bit. And it's one of these things that we can't do anything about, so we just don't mention it. We're just like, yeah, that happens.
Everyone knows that it's not ideal, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. It's one of those kind of things. But it's always, like, something you sort of bear in mind. And that's part of the problem with studying astrocytes. They're so sensitive cells that they will respond to this kind of stuff, because a part of their job is to protect the neurons, right? And they do this thing called reactive astrogliosis. Boom! Where they start sprouting massive tentacles and start looking...
For new neurons once you've taken them away.
Well, actually, so normally, like, they're kind of there holding the neurons in place, but as soon as you start smashing the tissue around, it thinks the brain's under attack. So the first thing it does is it starts sprouting these massive tentacles and going looking for stuff which might be causing this issue. And they're totally different once they do that.
Defense mode.
Exactly, they can change themselves entirely. So what you're trying to do is trying to understand how they work in reality, and what you often end up seeing is how they work after, say, like, a massive brain injury. So part of the skill is doing everything so calmly that you end up with
zen.
Yeah, so zen. Exactly. Very difficult when you've got that Rachmaninoff music playing in the background. that you don't change the tissue at all.
Very quickly, because we are running out of time, but I would love to know, what is your fieldwork faux pas? We ask this to everybody. Something that's, you know, gone wrong.
Well, so I didn't work the field, but I work in the lab. So when I worked there at the start, I used to swing in my chair quite a lot, because they kind of had, like, swivelly chairs.
Yeah.
And I swung in my chair, and at one point, like, my whole, like, rig, so I was reading all these signals off it, the rig just went dead. I was like, oh, what's happened? So I went and got my supervisor, and he was like, I don't know. Oh, I see what you've done. You've pulled all the wires out the front. And then he was like, I've been messing things up for a while. And finally, he was like, right, I've had enough. I'm going to see the boss. Got the boss. The boss came in and looked at it and went, I've never seen that done before. You're going to fix this. And then he said, do you know how to solder? I was like, yeah, I know how to solder. Right, you're going to solder this 100,000 pound amplifier back together. And I did. And it was just, yeah.
Oh my God.
I know that amplifier still rattles. I can't believe I'm saying that on radio. But yeah, that if you pick that amplifier up, I know which one it is. It rattles. It's filled with solder because I just couldn't do it very well. I'm not a good solder.
Thank God you knew how to. I would have no clue. Wow. So the challenges of working in the brain are manyfold. What is your fourth song?
I've actually forgotten. Is it?
Okay, it's Kendrick Lamar.
Oh, Kendrick Lamar. Yeah, so halfway through my PhD, I discovered Kendrick Lamar and like all this kind of lyrical hip-hop. And yeah, it really got me through. When the lights shut off and it's my turn to settle down, my main concern, promise that you will sing about me, promise that you will sing about me. I said when the lights shut off and it's my turn to settle down, my main concern, promise that you will sing about me, promise that you will sing about me. I woke up this morning and figured I'd call you in case I'm not here tomorrow. I'm hoping that I can borrow a peace of mind. I'm behind on what's really important. My mind is really distorted. I find nothing but trouble in my life.
News just in. Tiny robot insect can stick to things using static electricity.
Magic mushrooms may hold key to depression.
An 18th century mathematical theorem may shed new light on psychological disorders. magic mushroom worms. I think this is the biggest story of the week. I was kind of jealous that you chose it.
I know, it's huge, isn't it? So this guy, David Nutt, he's very famous, has been championing psychedelic drugs as a kind of potential cure for psychological disorders, basically because they send you into a psychedelic trip in which you reevaluate a lot of stuff and it gives you a completely new perspective, quite forcibly. But he's got this whole problem that the government... Like, basically, the government is a consensus to not get involved with psychedelics, and he doesn't understand why, because they could have medicinal potential, but he's been championing this for a while, and it's starting to come clear that he's right.
Yeah, it's so exciting. Great. Yes, yours as well, also kind of mental health.
Yeah, also on the same vein, kind of. So there's this theory in mathematics going back to the 18th century called Bayesian probability. I don't know if anyone's heard of it before, maybe in A-level maths. Anyway.
It rings a bell. I couldn't tell you what
it means. It's an equation to sort of work out the probability of something happening based on what's currently happening and then your previous experiences. So to calculate an expectation of something. So in some psychological disorders, you can kind of think of it within this mathematical framework. So for example, people who are autistic won't update their expectations according to their senses, but someone with schizophrenia will have this disconnect between what their previous expectations were and then what's happening now, and that will lead to hallucinations and delusions. Wow. So even though there may not be necessarily a clinical application of trying to break this down using maths, it may be quite comforting to try and explain to somebody that this is how your brain is working, and it might offer some respite.
I think understanding a mechanism 100% gives you kind of ownership. And well, for me anyway, if you understand why you are feeling or experiencing things the way you are, then you start to have a handle on it and start to be able to...
It can sound quite cold, but also if you just think about it like, oh, this is why my brain is doing this to me, rather than this is really happening and it's terrifying.
It helps you like separate illusion and reality. So this tiny insect robot is a new type of micro air vehicle, or MAV, and it literally looks like a little insect's been inspired by the way bees fly. It's called Robo Bee, and it's got a head the size of a 10p coin, which creates a static electric charge and allows it to stick to things like wood or glass or brick even, the way that if you rubbed a balloon on your hair, it would stick to the wall. And this means it can fly and then it can perch. And that uses like 3 times less energy. And this may be the new future of sort of swarm robots.
Of tiny robot bees.
Yeah.
This is the future
Could go out and like, you know, do search and rescue. Or I'm sure... this future sounds terrifying.
I saw a bumblebee. It was on the windowsill. I can't reach it. How do I get to that bee? Don't worry. I'll send a tiny robot bee lift that bee out and bring it to you where it can receive medical attention.
If people were like trapped in a burning, like a collapsed building, you could send in the tiny robot bees to find the bodies before you send in humans, because it's not that safe for humans.
Fine.
I mean, it's a long way off from that. And probably it will just be used for spying. But anyway, it's cool and it looks cute. So Google Robo Bee. Right, moving swiftly on to song 5, Ali. What have you got?
I don't know. Oh, you know, I do know.
Propeller Heads.
Oh, yeah. So this is the kind of music that I was listening to pretty much nonstop while I was writing my thesis. Yeah, just because you can't not concentrate when you're listening to this.
Brain is 73% water. It takes only 2% dehydration to affect your attention, memory, and other cognitive skills. 90 minutes of sweating can also temporarily shrink the brain as much as 1 year of aging.
Whoa.
I didn't even know that aging shrank your brain.
That sweating fact is scaring me now.
That's why it's important to stay hydrated. So, Ali, you've finished your PhD, and what is next?
Yeah, I eventually finished my PhD. And now,
with the help of that powerful music.
Exactly, on loop in a darkened laboratory. So now I'm really into science communication. I mean, I'm not sure I like that phrase, but basically my feeling is that science is kind of taking off in a kind of exponentially at the moment. And we're in danger of just disconnecting from the rest of the world and everybody kind of losing track of what we do and how we do it. Like in the Victorian era, anyone could do it in science, right? You just need to have it like a bell jar. Whereas now, no one can do science.
That was some high-tech stuff back then.
Yeah, fact. Okay, fine. I rescind that comment. But now, you know, you need a PhD to even start to understand a tiny part of it.
Mm.
And we've really got to make sure that everybody gets a shot at understanding how their world is being changed by what scientists do.
Yeah, I do think it's hugely important. I mean, you could invent a cure for cancer, but if that message doesn't get spread, then actually no cancer will get cured.
But I mean, even if you say you invent a cure for cancer, right? Nobody's like, right, yes, here, take this cure for cancer. You must be cured right now, right? Something is happening to you, and you have no idea what it is or how it's working, right? And all you have to go on is the word of someone else.
Yeah.
But it doesn't take a huge amount to just explain roughly how it works, and that gives you ownership over what you're doing to yourself.
Well, here at Science Mixtape, we obviously agree with you. So, what are you sort of doing towards that, or is that where you're going at the moment?
Yeah, so I make lots of videos about science, and I'm really trying to work out, I think we're always in a kind of state of trying to work out how best to do what we're trying to do. Well, that's a kind of meaningless thing to say, but what I would love to be able to do is to work out how narrative, which I think is the most powerful way of explaining anything, can be used to explain something as esoteric as a scientific idea.
I completely agree with you, but I'm just going to ask you to unpack that a bit for people listening at home. So when you say narrative to explain, like, what do you mean?
Okay, if I tell you a story, right? So if I say, look, I left my house this morning, right? And there were four buses parked outside, right? With no drivers, right? And then, like, even though that's a terrible start to a story, you're still like, right, why?
Yeah, you're engaged.
And then, you know, as the story unfolds, you want to hear about what's happening to me, why this is important to me, why this is important to you, all this kind of stuff. Science doesn't really have that. You're like, yes, it's important to you because you want to know what's going on, but there's no emotional connection and there's no narrative structure to what's happening. A story goes in, there's a discovery in the middle, and then it comes back out again, and it's about the change that happens to the characters that they're doing. But it doesn't work like that if you're trying to explain a scientific idea.
Well, often I find that, sometimes the story takes over. So I think that a lot of the way science has been portrayed in the past is the history of great men. It's like, this is Einstein, this is what he did. This is Newton, this is what he discovered. And that almost makes it seem like these people were incredible, and you could never be one of them because they were so special.
Yeah, I completely agree.
And it's so, like, I always think it's so important to get across the kind of collaboration and how, like, for instance, Galileo and his telescope, which is how he then sort of helped to prove that the Earth does go around the sun rather than the other way around. That is because he was growing up in a time of the Enlightenment and lots of kind of capitalist market culture springing up in Europe where people could be making things and selling them. And he'd heard about this telescope, so he made his own because he wanted to sell it and impress someone. And I don't know, like if there hadn't been that environment. So I think there's a theory that one of the reasons like China was so advanced compared to Europe, you know, they invented gunpowder before us, they invented loads of things. But there's a theory that because of their more kind of centralized structure and centralized kind of knowledge spread, and you didn't have this competitive element, that's why we then overtook them in that era.
I mean, there's the other sort of, and a slight tangent to that is the idea about the narrative of science itself. So science isn't like a box of facts, and occasionally we reach in and take one out. Like, it's all a narrative, and it's all trying to model our world, like have a successful model of it. And so we have stories about through all the realms of science as to how things work. We tell each other stories about how they work as scientists, right? And then we try and see if those stories are right. But you don't really get that vibe if you're not a scientist. You're just like, oh, yeah, they discovered something new. Oh, they discovered another thing new. Well, I guess that's just another thing to add to the list of things which are facts. And if you have that idea about it, as opposed to, oh, someone's told me a different story, that's the idea that I'd really like people to kind of get on board with. Is that, like, it's just a load of scientists telling each other stories, and some of them are more convincing.
Yeah. And I find that the challenge of that, though, for science communication is you often, when you're telling a story, it's you know, it's about the person, like you said. We actually studied this when I was at uni, and you've got these two narratives. You've got the mythic, which is the kind of fairy tale story. You've got the hero going on his quest. And most stories you can kind of put into these sort of fairy tale spheres. So the scientist is going on a quest to discover something, and the enemy is, or the villain is, you know, maybe it's the current regime that don't believe him or whatever, and he gets helpers along the way. And so you've got that story, but then you've also got the mimetic narrative, which is the argument, and that's the kind of what the science points are. And getting those two to marry up and not have one dominate, that's a real challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. And to transfer the feeling of inspiration that the scientist is getting about the information that he's discovering to the audience, like, that's very difficult to do without you really, like, identifying with the scientist himself, which I think is totally what you like to do with what you were saying before, which is people are a product of their environment. Yeah. And the science that they make is a product of their environment.
Yeah.
Not because science is a box of things which are true, but just because it's the story they tell given the environment that they're in.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, we have this whole rational view of science, and we're all humans, and we all have, like, faults with the way we perceive things. We're all biased in some ways.
Exactly.
So, like, aware of them.
You kind of want to say, like, I want to take, like, the big scientists of today, like, you'd ideally, and you'd be like, look, well, where did you come from? Right? What were you? You were a doctor before. Where did you... Yeah.
Sorry, that was really offbeat of me.
What were you? You were a doctor before. Were you in the army? Like, what country did you come from? Did you move? Like, what are you in this because you want to be a great scientist? Or are you in this because there's something in the world which doesn't make sense to you? Like, what are the things which drive you? And that will translate into what the science is that you make.
God, I could talk about this all day, but we have 2 minutes left. So,
oh, it's ideal.
It is time to reveal the answer to our brain teaser. Ali, what was your best guess? Because you revealed you didn't actually know this.
69 million.
You're close. Yaz, do we have any guesses?
We've got some guesses around the sort of tens of thousands, nothing that high, and one very helpful person saying that he hasn't got very many left. Don't know what that's supposed to mean. Guess it's Saturday morning.
There's a myth that we have as many neurons as stars in the Milky Way. Now, we don't have quite as many. There's like 200 to 400 billion stars of galaxies in the Milky Way, I should say. And the current estimate is that we have 86 billion neurons in our brain. So, yeah, a lot. And the way they discovered this was they sort of dissolved a brain, had it sloshing around as a soup, and then counted how many nuclei, which are the sort of sensitive cells.
That's how I try and solve most problems.
Make a soup. So what is your final song to go out on?
This song is just a beautiful song. That's it.
It's by Seven Suns, and it's called Lift Every Voice.
Ring with the harmony of liberty. Let our rejoicing rise high as the listening sky. Let it resound